You are looking live at Chicken Dinner.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
I think I'll take two chickens.
Go on riverboat gambling trips.
You're going to die for some chickens.
Hey, what's your chicken dinner?
Someone is.
It was feathers yesterday. There was no chicken.
What you got riding on this game?
My daughter.
What a gambler.
It's Chicken Dinner.
Hey, Babalugas, we got a bet here.
Here's your host, Sam Panionovich.
It's called Winner, Winner, Chicken Dinner right there, boys.
Let's get this thing going.
Winner, Winner, Chicken Dinner. How about that?
Away we go. Chicken Dinner, Thursday, June 10th, 2021. Follow us on Twitter at ChickenXDinner, Instagram at ChickenDinnerSP, and smash the button so you get this mother clucker once it goes live. We will talk to Ariel Epstein, host of The Morning After on Sports Grid. We'll dive inside the American League East betting markets. Why do the books still disrespect the Boston Red Sox? I don't know. You can still find the Sox at like 4-1. One book has plus 425. If you think they can contend by the time September 1st rolls around, I would argue that's a good bet. The offense has been great. And oh, by the way, they get Chris Sale back sometime in July. They don't have to win the division, but I'm telling you, at plus $4 right now on June 10th, that price won't be available if they're in contention and in the hunt by the time the final month rolls around. Also, Ariel has two NFL win totals she's already in love with. That's right. Season starts in September, and she's ready to fire on June 10th. I want to start by talking about, you know, I sent a tweet out last night. I get these messages all the time, and this one just blew me last night because I said, look, I'm going to play the Bruins money line. I'm willing to go down with the ship. I won't quit these guys. Good luck. Yeah, they're probably going to lose, but I have too much pride to pass them up. I'm going to take them again on the road in Game 6, even though I don't feel that great about it. And I get tweets all the time and DMs when I lose, and people always say, you know, don't let it bother you. Don't let it bother you. You're above that. It's not a big deal. I don't know why. It's just when somebody creates multiple accounts, like there's this guy that creates an account, and I always block him. And then every time I have a bad day or two or three in a row, he will create a new account and just blast me, tweet at Nesson. It's exhausting. And it's a really sad life when you think about it. But this person sends me a tweet after the Bruins go down 3-1 in the second period and says something like, this guy is fucking clueless. Best fade material in the world. None of that is true. Tags Nesson in the tweet. It's a really sad life. That's the takeaway from this. But it just, God, I hate getting messages like that. It's one thing if you're upset and I know who you are. We've had exchanges in the past. But when you create a Twitter account to tweet at somebody who's giving free picks out, I don't get it. It really bothers me sometimes. The anonymity and the cowardice hiding behind some burner account. Of course, there's nothing that comes from a person like this. Literally within the last 2 weeks when I went on a 9-1 run. Crickets. You don't hear shit. I follow up a 9-1 run with a run currently 1-6. Look, I'm not happy. I think all of you know I'm not happy. I don't do this to give out losers. But we still have more winners than losers. It's just frustrating sometimes. The 12th or 13th tweet, yeah, it bothers me. And like, this is the stuff you deal with. And sometimes it makes it hard to wake up and be like, you know what? I want to do content again. It's the life I chose. It's the life I live. Something about somebody with zero followers over and over and over again. I don't understand it. Don't you have something better to do? Apparently not. The Bruins are dead. Sucks because the future, I thought we got a great number before the Taylor Hall trade. Bruins were 14-16-1. We talked about it a lot on this show. And going into that fourth game against the Islanders, the Bruins were plus 375, 4-1 to win the Stanley Cup. And they fell apart game four. They got blitzed in game five. And game six, it was all she wrote. I thought Ty Anderson said it best. He covers the Bruins for 98.5, the Sports Hub here in Boston. We're going to talk about goalies and second-guessing Cassidy, the head coach, Bruce Cassidy. But losing Brandon Carlo is what flipped this series. I agree with that. Carlo had stifled Barzal through the first two games and so. Through the first two games and change. They lose Carlo. Barzal comes alive. The penalty kill was Swiss cheese. And the Bruins suddenly only had one playoff quality pairing. Defense is something you just have to have in the postseason. I remember covering those Blackhawk teams from 2012 to 2017, early 2018. And when the Hawks were at their best, yeah, we talked a lot about Jonathan Toews and Patrick Kane, Marian Hossa, Patrick Sharp, Brandon Saad. At the end of the day, they won their Stanley Cups with a tremendous blue line and a very, very good goaltender. They've got two Hall of Famers in that bunch. Duncan Keith, Brent Seabrook. Nicholas Jalmerson was very, very good. Johnny Oduya as a four-man, outstanding. You win by keeping the puck away from your blue line and near the other blue line. Keep it away from your net and away from your zone. And the Boston Bruins, after Game 3, couldn't do that. I still think the Islanders stink. I don't want to use the term lucky because you don't get lucky 8 times in 3 weeks. You know, they beat the Pittsburgh Penguins and the Boston Bruins. Fluky, I don't know. Am I a little bitter? Probably. That team maximizes your mistakes, and that's what Barry Trotz teams have always done. You tip your cap. All the loose pucks, boom, back of the net. Varlamov comes out to play a puck, crisis averted. Rask comes out to play a puck, it ends up in the back of the net. And how many turnovers? Grizzlick was awful last night in Game 6. It's a 1-1 game. He's in the neutral zone. Actually, I think he was in his own zone, and Brock Nelson just picked his pocket. 1-on-0, boom. 2-1 Isles. Building's alive. It was it. Now the conversation in Boston will center on the net. And I think watching this series, they need help on the blue line, and they need some physicality back there. You got some guys missing, but everybody's got guys missing. Injuries are not really an excuse. Brandon Carlo's not a top guy, but he's an important guy. I think the Bruins need to find a guy on the blue line and pay him. Chara, you can't replace Chara, but you don't want Chara anymore either. And Torrey Krug, more of an offensive guy. Good on the power play. They need some stable blue line defenders. And the guys in the system ain't ready yet. Jared Tenorti is out there in a Stanley Cup playoff series. Not good. And how about this? The Colorado Avalanche, after winning the first two games, including a 7-1 win in game number one, they are now down 3-2 in the series. You talk about pins and needles right there. That thing has swung like crazy. The Avs were as high as minus 900 after they won the first two games. They lose 3, they lose 4, and they lose in overtime, game number 5 on Tuesday night. So now the Avs have gone from a favorite, about minus $182 before the series, to as high as $9 to, oh, by the way, they are now the series underdog. Because they have to win 6 on the road, and they have to win 7 at home, and in Game 7, anything goes. Playoff hockey, up, down, up, down, up, down. But I'm sad that we have to light our Bruins futures on fire, and I'm still pissed at myself for not putting one of the tickets on Prop Swap when I could have almost tripled my money. Got greedy. But I didn't think the Bruins up 2-1 were going to lose a series, and that's the reality. I don't know how I missed this last week. I took a screenshot last Thursday before I headed out to watch Game 3. Gambet DC, I know some of you know about this. They're like the cousin of Sportsbet Montana. They're both run by a company called Intralot, which is apparently the best in the business at making shitty lines. I forgot to get to this, and I wish I did, but here are the betting splits for Game 3 between the Boston Bruins and the New York Islanders. Game is in Long Island. Bruins on the road. Bruins minus 167. Islanders come back plus 105. What? If I'm laying minus 165 or minus 167, I want back at least plus 145. A 20-cent straddle. 167 to plus 105? Come on. And it gets worse with the total. The total, 4.5 minus 175 on the over. Yeah, that's not a typo. I am not mispronouncing anything. To go over 4.5 minus 175. Are you kidding? And the under 4.5 plus 110. What? Those splits aren't even, it's make-believe. How do you deal that? That's the betting scene in Washington, D.C. That's Gambet, D.C., run by the lottery. This is what happens when the lottery is in control. And this is why the lottery should not be in control. How the fuck do you offer minus 175 and plus 110? How is that the straddle? That's awful for the consumer. That's great for business. It's great for the book. Not good for you, the better. Don't even bet there. Go bet with a bookie. Don't lay minus 175. And the total was 5. Mark it. By the way, the Bruins won that game 2-1. Imagine betting over 4.5 minus 175 and losing 2-1. That's awful. Now, it's not as bad. Those numbers and odds aren't as bad as Sportsbet Montana, but it's close. Got a question about hedging. Kyle Dietz, one of our loyal listeners to Chicken Dinner. Sam, I've got the Suns 35-1 to win the title before the season and a 6-1 bet on the Brooklyn Nets. I was wondering if I should hedge at all going forward. I'm cool if you want to address this on the next pod, but I seriously don't know if I should hedge or ride. Thanks. Always love the content. Well, I appreciate you, Kyle. Thanks for reaching out. I did message him back right away, but this is a couple days ago. I said, I wouldn't hedge anything yet because you're a heavy favorite in both series. You know, the Nets, I think, had already went up 1-0, and the Suns had gone up 1-0 on the Nuggets. So there's really not a point to hedge at this point because the math says both of those teams are getting through. What I did tell Kyle is that I would bet futures on the winner of Jazz Clips and maybe on the winner of Sixers Hawks. I still don't think anybody's beating Brooklyn in the East. And Brooklyn at 6-1, you don't really have, I mean, you could still hedge it, obviously, but you have much better opportunities with the Phoenix side of the bracket where you have them 35-1. This exchange was a couple days ago, so let's see what the market has done since then. Real talk, the Clippers at plus 850 right now isn't a bad pop. The Clips and Jazz were both about 5-1 before the series started. Jazz win game one, Clippers go to 850. Jazz go to about 3-1 or less. So this could be worth a bullet right now in that Western bracket. I don't know how much Kyle has, but let's imagine it's $100 on the Suns at 35-1. That's $3,500. I would put $200 right now on the Clippers at 8-1, $850. If they lose game two, they're probably cooked. But that number is already substantially higher than it was before game one. Before game one, they're 5-1. After game one, they're plus 850. Last I checked, it's a 7-game series. And before either of these series started in this round, before any of them started for that matter, the Suns had lower odds than the Clippers and the Jazz. Like I said, Clips and Jazz were about 5-1. The Suns were 7 or 8-1. So that's telling you the winner of Clips Jazz is going to be the favorite, probably, against the Suns. Now, I don't think the Sixers or Hawks are going to win the title, so even if it's Brooklyn against one of those two, I just don't see it happening. Even without James Harden, if he doesn't play, I wouldn't hedge that. I think Brooklyn has French doors to the finals. They have too many weapons and too much scoring. That'd be a fun series with them and the Hawks, but the Hawks are the little brother of the Nets. They play very similar. Nets just have better players and better scorers. So I wouldn't – I don't even think I would hedge that side. And Brooklyn, Utah was my pick before the playoffs. I'm going to stick to that. But Kyle's in a hell of a position with the Suns at 35-1 and the Nets at 6-1. That's what I would do. I would hedge. I would put a little bit on the Clippers heading into game two. And then if the Jazz win game two, you might want to just bet the Jazz. I mean, 3-1 on Utah. You go into that Western Conference final with 3-1 on Utah or 850 on the Clippers, and then you've got 6-1 on the Suns. You're set on that side, and you probably have Brooklyn. Good spot. Good bets. I was looking at Finals MVP odds, by the way. I don't know that there's any value in the current numbers. I mean, I looked at FanDuel, for example. FanDuel's got Kevin Durant at plus 145. He's probably the guy. The numbers say that. 100 wins, 145. I'm going to read you the FanDuel list, and then I want to compare across the three American books that have prices up. All right, FanDuel's got Durant plus 145. Mitchell plus 350. Kawhi Leonard plus 950. That seems kind of high. Devin Booker, 10-1. Joel Embiid, 10-1. James Harden, 16-1. Chris Paul, 18. Giannis, 18. Kyrie Irving, 20-1. But you should always shop around inside the market. So Durant, let's take Durant for example. He's plus 140 at DraftKings, plus 145 at FanDuel, plus 170 at PointsBet. So you make a little extra scratch if you bet it with PointsBet. You bet 100, you win 140 at DraftKings, 145 at FanDuel, 170 at PointsBet. Not a big disparity, but still a difference. Here we go, though. Donovan Mitchell, plus 350 at FanDuel, plus 375 at DraftKings, plus 550 at PointsBet. And you guys know I like Utah. And if Utah wins the title, we're talking about Mitchell or Gobert winning the MVP. James Harden, 7-1 at PointsBet. Wow. 16-1 at FanDuel, 17-1 at DraftKings. It's a pretty decent shift. You bet 100, you win 700 at PointsBet, and you win a lot more at the other two books. Kawhi Leonard, 8-1 DraftKings, 850 PointsBet, 950 FanDuel. Embiid, 850 DraftKings, 10-1 FanDuel, 11-1 PointsBet. Devin Booker, pretty much 850, 10-1 everywhere. And here's the biggest differentiation. Rudy Gobert at PointsBet, plus 850. 27-1 at FanDuel, 30-1 at DraftKings. I'm not saying bet Rudy Gobert. I'm just saying if you're going to bet Rudy Gobert, don't fucking bet him at PointsBet. That $100 bet at PointsBet will win you $800. It will make you $2,700 at FanDuel and $3,000 at DraftKings. Always be shopping, period. Big cash for Nikola Jokic backers to win the MVP. Jokic was as high as 36-1 to win the award. Our buddy Joe O hit it for $100. Nice payout there. And Joe tweeted the other night, "We waited so long for this moment, I want to cry." That's an addition to the man cave right there, $3,600. I wish I got invested there. I didn't even think about Jokic, much like I didn't think about Lefty. Maybe I do suck at my job. Two more quick ones before we get to Ariel Epstein. Illinois had the second highest handle in April across the country. I love that we get the April numbers in June, but that's Illinois in a nutshell. Nothing is ever on time and nothing ever makes sense. Chris Altruda had the story for Sports Handle. New Jersey, $747.99 million in handle. Illinois, $537 million. Pennsylvania, $479 million. Nevada, $458 million. Michigan, $274. Colorado, $244. Illinois, second in the country as far as dollars wagered. And the state took in, I believe, $7.1 million after taxes. That's how much the state of Illinois made. Well, it's not that much. Well, let's say every month is going to be that high going forward. Now, that won't be true because you won't have handle in June or July like you do in April. But let's say the state makes $5 million a month. 12 months a year, that's $60 million that they put in their pockets for just taking bets. People are going to go elsewhere anyways. If you don't have legal betting, you might as well put that $60 million back into the state. But that's impressive. Didn't take long for Illinois to hop up to the two spot. New Jersey, Illinois, Pennsylvania. Then Nevada. And according to Mike Mutnanski from WEEI Radio, there will be a sports betting hearing next Thursday in Massachusetts. Mutt adds lawmakers will testify on the bills that have been filed. There are many, but this is a logical first step to legalize sports betting in time for NFL season. I don't know. Too many cooks in the kitchen. Too many bills. And the Senate didn't even put it in the budget. That's a problem. That's been the issue. Too many people want too many things. And I think they're at 13 or 14 bills. Thing is, I don't think they're passing a sports betting bill in itself, like an island bill. I think the best chance is to figure out the best plan and jam it into a different bill and pass it that way. That's very common. That's what happened in Illinois, as you know. It wasn't a sports betting bill. It was a vertical capital bill. It just got wedged in there, and then everybody signed it, and here we are. Second highest state in April for dollars wagered. There are a lot of critics and a lot of skeptics. I don't know. By football season, I'd make Massachusetts the underdog to have sports betting. Joining us on Chicken Dinner, she calls herself the prop queen, but she doesn't have an ego, I promise. Her name is Ariel Epstein. She's a host of The Morning After on Sports Grid. You can see her doing content for MSG. And I saw you doing some basketball betcast. I feel like you're everywhere these days, Ariel.
Thanks for having me on. So excited. I also have my Chicken Dinner sweatshirt, which I wear very regularly. So it feels fitting to be back. I'm glad that you feel I'm everywhere. It feels as if I'm working everywhere and all the time, but the gambling world doesn't stop. So it makes sense.
But you also don't really physically go everywhere. You're in the same place, but you're everywhere because you're doing it out of your studio, which is in your place.
I absolutely love this whole work from home thing. A lot of people are ready to get back in the studio. I guess I am too. I should be social. The one thing COVID did to me, it made me pretty antisocial. It makes my work a lot easier, but now I'm just so used to sitting at home and getting so much done. The second I start commuting, I feel as if I'm going to lose so much time in my day.
I feel like the worst thing about this pandemic for you is that it has figuratively and literally turned you into a half-ass dresser because you're ready for work on top, but I know you have sweatpants underneath.
I'm wearing the ugliest sweatpants. I'm wearing purple sweatpants with black stars on it, but I'm wearing a really nice top. You're right, 100%.
AL East odds. How about that for a transition? I can't get over, it feels like at this point, disrespect for the Red Sox. Because they just wiped the floor with the Yankees, including a crushing Sunday loss that they dealt the Bronx Bombers. Yankees should have won that game, but they lose. They lose three in a row. And it's almost as if the AL East odds didn't change. The Yankees still have lower odds than the Red Sox. How?
It's very strange. But here's the thing. The Yankees are always going to be the team that is booked. Like, the book is always going to look at the Yankees with rose-colored glasses. No matter what the Yankees do, they are always going to be favored in some capacity. Now, the biggest surprise was watching Tampa Bay go from being the second-best odds to the first-best odds on FanDuel. And it made sense because Tampa Bay is the reigning American League champs. They're in first place by a game and a half right now on the Red Sox. The Yankees are 6.5 games back. Not only should the Red Sox be higher on the odds board, they should at least be closer to the Yankees if they weren't. Right now, you're seeing such a big differential between the two of them. It's just telling me that the book doesn't have as much faith in this Red Sox rotation. They've been holding their own. They've been a good home team. Boston 17 and 14 straight up at home. They're great on the road. 20 and 10 on the road is amazing. Is it sustainable? For the Yankees, a lot of people don't feel we've seen the best of them yet. We haven't. We've seen the absolute worst in them. They're one of the worst teams with runners in scoring position in baseball this year, ranking inside the bottom 10. The Red Sox, on the other hand, they've looked good to start the season. Just can the pitching be sustainable? And that's the main question.
I feel like it's still a good bet on the Red Sox, though, given the fact that you can still find prices at 4-1 or higher. And maybe I'm a little bit biased because I'm close to the team, I guess. I don't cover the team, but I'm already invested over 78.5. Some of my friends have them to win the pennant, which I don't know that that's going to happen either. But I also saw a video of Chris Sale throwing the ball in a bullpen session yesterday. So if he returns in July, which is the plan, and the offense, you know, stays the way they've been, this team should be in contention, Ariel, and that's all I'm trying to get at. I feel like if you think the Red Sox can contend by September 1, that's a great bet at plus 350 or 4-1 or higher.
Right. And then you look at what the Boston, what the Red Sox bullpen has been doing. ERA, they're a top 10 bullpen ERA. You look to their starting rotation, and they've been a top 10 starting rotation with a 3.76 ERA. When it comes to runners in scoring position, they're inside the top 15 range, at least the last time I checked. Yet it's all about sustaining that starting rotation. Martin Perez has been pretty good. And I know that there are a bunch of pitchers in the Red Sox rotation that I've been looking at for strikeout props. The Red Sox are a team that you can't fade right now, but the Yankees, we haven't seen the best of in their bats yet. Now, can the Yankees bats heat up at some point? I will never forget a few years ago where the Tampa Bay Rays were in second place by about 10 games with the Yankees in first in August. In September, the Yankees went on this major slump. The Rays got super hot. And after being 10 games back, the Rays end up beating out the Yankees for the American League East Division. So much can change after the All-Star break. Everything comes down to what are these teams really going to do when the trade deadline approaches at the end of next month? That's going to be a huge storyline to watch out for, especially with teams that are overachieving more than we even thought. For example, I could see a team such as the Cleveland Indians making a big trade. They're only 4 games back of the Chicago White Sox in the Central. The Red Sox could go for a big piece. They're a team that a lot of people projected to be the 4th or 5th worst team in this American League East Division. Other teams are now in play for the trade deadline that you're going to have to keep a close eye on and maybe even get some value on before the trade deadline even starts.
Would you bet $10 on the Orioles at 300-1?
No! No, okay, first of all, my whole family's from Baltimore. My dad's entire side of the family's from Baltimore. It's giving them false hope. It's giving them the encouragement that they need to continue to bash the Yankees. I became a Yankees fan because my mom and her side of the family is from New York. My grandpa's been taking me to Yankees games for my whole life. My dad absolutely hates the Yankees. There's no team he'd love to watch suffer more than this team right now.
Where does your dad rank Lamar Jackson in quarterbacks in the division?
He'll probably say number one because he's a big homer. But for Lamar, we're on the Lamar bandwagon. We like him. I would take Lamar Jackson over any of the quarterbacks in that division right now. Joe Burrow, he still only is 1 year in. Haven't seen too much of him yet. But with the ACL tear, how's he going to come back in his second year? How much are they going to produce around him? But as for the Ravens, Lamar Jackson's the most versatile quarterback in the AFC North. Big Ben, Ben Roethlisberger, he's out of there after, next year? It's going to be his last year. Baker Mayfield, he had two of the best receivers in football and still can't get to a Super Bowl. Lamar Jackson's been dealing with wide receivers for his entire career. I still have faith in him. I'm just very disappointed that the Ravens didn't go for any top-notch wide receivers such as a Kenny Galladay or a Julio Jones.
Yeah, you guys have, I think, the best coach regular season-wise in football. I think they,
and
for
special
years,
teams.
They were good forever with 16 games. You could just pencil them in for 9, maybe even 10, which is a lot in the NFL, especially in that division. I mean, the Ravens and Steelers were going at each other's throats for years, and the Bengals were still pretty decent. Marvin Lewis was a good coach regular season as well. But I look at this win total here. I see 10.5. How can I go under 10.5? I know the juice sucks. I'm not a fan of laying minus 155 to go over 10.5, but I'm not going under with Baltimore.
Last year, I liked the under on Baltimore because it was a major, major sell high situation. You were looking at a team that had the second best win total behind the Kansas City Chiefs. I wasn't buying it. I say the same thing this year. I would stay away from the win total just because they didn't do anything to really. And I know people will knock me for this, but they really didn't do much to better the offense. Rashad Bateman's an amazing wide receiver out of college. He's a year one rookie wide receiver. I'm not going to say that the Ravens are all of a sudden going to be this better team because of him. We'll see what happens. But the offense hasn't really changed much. That's what concerns me. We don't have another wide receiver on the Ravens that can be the crutch for Lamar Jackson. That's what they needed. I would stay away from the win total. There are other win totals that I find way more intriguing than the Baltimore Ravens, especially in that division in the AFC North.
Okay. Like who?
Well, the win total that I'm alluding to that I like the most would be not in the AFC North. It's the Jacksonville Jaguars. But in the AFC North, I don't mind taking an under on the Cleveland Browns. You could be in a good sell high situation. I look at the Cleveland Browns like I did the Baltimore Ravens last year. Last year, everyone thought the Ravens were going to be the Super Bowl team. They're amazing. They have a good defense. Lamar was the MVP. That's similar conversation to what we're having about Cleveland the last few years. Cleveland hit the over on their win total last year. This year coming in, they're thinking, okay, maybe Odell Beckham Jr. is back from his torn ACL. Baker Mayfield, another year under his belt. This defense looks amazing. Oh my gosh, Jadeveon Clowney. And you've got Myles Garrett on the other side. This team on paper is great. Don't we always get stuck in this, that the team on paper looks great and then it gets to the season and the Browns still can't score in the red zone the way that they haven't been able to score for the last couple of years? I would take an under on their win total, especially because it's right in the same realm as the Ravens.
Obviously, shop around always. You can go under 10.5 at BetMGM at plus money. If you go to DraftKings, you have to lay 125 to go under 10.5. And then William Hill's lowest at market, they're under 10 plus a quarter, plus 125. I'm curious on your Jacksonville thoughts, not only on the win total, but your thoughts on some of these Trevor Lawrence touchdown props. I see like 23.5. I'm like, oh my God. I know that we've seen quarterbacks go over that number, namely Justin Herbert, but with that offensive line and that receiver room, I don't know that he's a layup for 24 passing touchdowns.
No, and think of who's coming out of his backfield. You have one of the best running backs in football last year coming out there in James Robinson. Even number one on the list, they put Travis Etienne at number one running back on ESPN right now on the depth chart, which is absolutely crazy. James Robinson was great. He was a top five running back last year. He was the best rookie running back in football. Then Travis Etienne, who knows Trevor Lawrence, they played together at Clemson. You're going to have two dynamic running backs. You're throwing them in the mix with wide receivers DJ Chark, Marvin Jones, LaVisca Chenault. Are they good? Yeah. But you're going to have running backs as your crutch. If you get inside the red zone, are you going to ask Trevor Lawrence to throw? Or are you going to ask Travis Etienne or James Robinson to run the ball in? I'm going to see them go and run the ball more. But again, they're always going to have these oversaturated lines on the number one pick in the NFL draft. That's why I'm going under on their win total. It's one of my favorite ones to go under on because you look at what they're slated at right now, at least on FanDuel, it's at 6.5. You're asking a team to get 4 more wins than they got last year, 5 more wins. And no, those kinds of ratios are almost impossible. If you look back in all of these last years, unless it was a team that had an injury such as the Dallas Cowboys with Dak Prescott who missed the season, you have a whole new system. You have a new head coach in Urban Meyer who's coming in from the college ranks for the first time in his career. You have a rookie quarterback. You have a rookie running back. There's a lot to learn about yourselves. Look at the Cincinnati Bengals. They had the number one pick in the draft in Joe Burrow last year. They also still couldn't get over their win total.
Yeah, there might be two easy ones against Houston, but aside from that, I don't think they're a lock to win 7 games. Not a chance. And then back to the offense and the scheme, Urban Meyer was successful pretty much everywhere he went for the way that his teams ran the football. They always dominated the line of scrimmage, and for all the talk about Justin Fields being an awesome Ohio State quarterback, Urban Meyer never had Justin Fields. He had a great offensive line, and he had running backs that he put in the NFL.
Exactly. And you could even look to a few of those, like J.K. Dobbins on the Ravens. You just look at these running backs that he produced at Ohio State.
Zeke Elliott.
Focus. Exactly. They're going to focus on the run game. You could look. And the problem here is you can't even focus in on Travis Etienne because he's going to be splitting carries with James Robinson. Robinson has given the Jaguars no reason to not use him. He was incredible last year. He was one of my favorite prop bets. The props that I would love to take on James Robinson, such as his rushing yards props or his rushing plus receiving props, those were so great. No one ever caught on to James Robinson until about, I would say, more than halfway through the season. Travis Etienne, he's another back. I just don't see a world where the Jaguars are going to have to force Trevor Lawrence to throw to this mediocre wide receiver core, which, granted, I'm not taking anything away from DJ Chark. He's fun to watch. He's fast. He's good at coming up with contested balls. Ultimately, it's always going to be an exaggerated line on the number one pick in the NFL draft. And with Urban Meyer coming in, everyone's going to be excited to watch Jacksonville. And what? So we're going to throw to Tim Tebow. That'll be the big hype train. Trevor Lawrence, Urban Meyer, and Tim Tebow. Yes.
I smell an under.
It's my favorite under in the win totals for the NFL this year.
Can we move to sports betting Twitter, please? Pretty please.
Uh-oh.
I don't know who some of these people think they are. I'm not naming names because I don't have to, but some of these fucking people, the cojones, Ariel, on some of these people, I don't get who they think they are.
I know we already texted about this today. I got Venmo'd $25 from somebody. Then I got the DM explaining that they were just very happy about the picks I've given out. Thank you for picking some winners. That was super nice. I just can't believe somebody found me on Venmo, Venmo'd me $25. Go and take your winnings. I give them out for a reason. Go and have some fun. Go to lunch. Take somebody out. I don't want anyone's money. These things are so crazy what social media allows us to do. Just the easy access that everyone has to anybody. It's why I first loved Twitter. I used to love to go on Twitter. I was one of those randoms when I was in 9th grade. I first signed up for Twitter. I thought it was really cool that the Yankees beat writers were on there. I remember DMing a bunch of the Yankees beat writers, explaining that I wanted to be in journalism and I really wanted to be a reporter for a team. I'm a big Yankees fan. I thought it was really cool to have the access to some of these reporters right there. Then I look back on it now, I say, oh my gosh, I was one of those weirdos. I was someone that slid into DMs. Was that a weird thing in 2009? I don't know.
Yeah, I'm trying to picture myself being a Yankees beat writer and a 9th grade Ariel Epstein slides into my DMs.
It's so uncomfortable to think about.
But I think you would trade those DMs for some of the DMs you get now.
Yeah, without a doubt. I see some. I'll see a message go into those. You know, you get those direct messages that don't show up in your general populated messages. You go into that extra column of like message requests.
Mm-hmm.
When I see that pop up, I go, "Oh no!" And sometimes, if you're not friends or if you don't follow the person on Twitter, if they send you an image, you can't, you have to click extra. It says you do not follow this person. Click this image to see what they sent. I don't click it. I never know what someone sends me. If you send me a picture and I don't follow you, I never look because I don't know what's behind closed doors. If I say click this picture, I'm super nervous of what's going to pop up.
Oh, that's like Russian roulette when you click that picture.
Right. You don't know what's going to pop up.
Yeah, it could be a 16
slip,
parlay or
it could be something else.
Oh, I just mean the way some people talk on Twitter and the way some people act in real life. I don't know the bravado or the sense of bravado that these people feel like they have. It makes me laugh.
Hiding behind avatars. Those are always the best ones.
Your K props. You're very popular with the K props. Some would say you're a trendsetter with the K props. Who's been your favorite K prop pitcher this year? Is there somebody you either have made a lot of money on or somebody that you circle every time they start?
Shane Bieber of the Cleveland Indians is a name that I always circle. He's someone that I keep a close eye on. At first, I started blind betting all of his overs. I figured at some point, when you look back at the end of the regular season, you would profit more than you would have lost. Yet I have backed off a little bit because the matchups haven't been there. Another thing you look at, not necessarily about strikeout props for a pitcher, go target lefties facing the Detroit Tigers. The Detroit Tigers have the highest K rate in baseball. That K rate goes up by about 3% when they face left-handed pitchers, still being the highest K rate in baseball against lefties. That's what I like to target, lefties against the Detroit Tigers.
That's really interesting. Yeah, if you just play the numbers, especially a 3% increase, people are listening like, well, that's not a lot. 3% takes me from 55 to 58% success rate, you know? So 3% in this racket, I would argue that's even better than people would think.
Huge, especially when the number goes from 27% strikeout rate to 30% strikeout rate. That's just astronomical numbers for the amount of strikeouts that a team has against a certain pitcher. There are so many different trends. People always talk about trends and you shouldn't always rely on them. If a pitcher's a lefty and he's prone to striking out batters, there are times where it doesn't necessarily work. There are times where a pitcher is a lefty going up against the Tigers, who I may have never heard of before. Maybe I lay off then. Most of the time, if it's a lefty that I've heard of, a lefty that I know is known for strikeouts, then I'm going to go and bet that almost every time. Yesterday, Seattle had Marco Gonzalez on the mound, and he's a lefty going up against the Tigers. I circled that, highlighted it, said that's the K-prop. That's my favorite one of the day that I'm going to keep a close eye on. I don't even think they ended up posting the number. But those are the things that I look for, these kinds of trends where you have K rates that go up because they're either at home and they strike out more, or they're facing a lefty or righty. The San Francisco Giants went for the longest time without being inside the top 10 overall with highest K rate. Yet when you look to the team that strikes out the most against right-handed pitchers, San Francisco was number one. Overall, they weren't even inside the top 10 against righties, highest K rate in baseball.
How would you describe the Saturday we all had together as a group in Las Vegas from start to finish?
Did it happen? Do we
it
know?
Did happen. Well, I had to check the next morning to see if Syracuse won, and I was not happy.
Oh, I didn't have to check that. I knew they lost.
I had no idea.
Here was the thing. I actually did pretty well in Vegas to start. We were there for March Madness. It was so much fun going to Circa, going up to Circa. I'm going to mess it up. I call it Circa Swim, but
Stadium
I know it's
Swim.
Not called that. Stadium Swim. And it was my highlight of the trip, watching everybody outside at all the TVs. Out of nowhere, you turn around to have a conversation. Then you hear cheering. You know everyone's on a certain side. We had so much fun watching those games in the day. I even had a better time because in the day, I hit all of my bets. Then at night, we end up going to the Westgate. Thank you to John Murray. Shout out. Mm-hmm. And we had a fun time until the Syracuse game came on. I doubled up on everything Syracuse because I'm an absolute idiot homer. I would have never done this in real life, but I was in Vegas and that's not real life. I just doubled up on everything Syracuse, where I bet my normal unit size on everything else in the day. I lost everything. Everything I made in the day, gone because of the Syracuse orange. Idiot.
I had at least five of those frozen whiskey cokes at Stadium Swim.
Oh my gosh. I absolutely loved the rosé. That was amazing. I had too many.
It was a great time. But I still am a little salty at the fact that you took my coveted title in pool basketball at John Murray. You couldn't miss. I couldn't believe it. You were half the time, I don't even think you were looking at the basket. Just whoosh.
I'm so bad at basketball, too. I don't know how this happened. I just wasn't missing. You couldn't hit anything. I mean, I don't know what went on that day, whether it was something that was in the drinks, whether it was John Murray rubbing a little bit of luck on someone other than you. I mean, like, I don't know. I think I was just the most well-liked person in the room that day, and the luck was on my side.
Yeah, it was an incredible performance, and you were not the favorite to win that night, but you
No. Big underdog cashing. In fact, I probably, out of the four or five people that were there that night, was the biggest dog, no doubt.
I have one final question for Ariel Epstein from Sports Grid. This one might be a little personal, but I think that you're bold enough to handle it and take it where you want to take it. We are both very good friends with Kelly Stewart, who got hired by ESPN, and ESPN took a lot of jobs away from her to bring her in and employ her at a very good contract rate, and she was set up. They have since terminated her over tweets that were deleted 9 years ago and that she had already served punishments for at previous companies. But many losers decided to regurgitate and blast these screenshots of deleted tweets to her employer, and she is no longer working there. How did you react to that, that whole situation?
The way I reacted to it is it's very scary what goes on in the world today with anything you post on social media can come back to bite you. I remember thinking back to middle school where I was in class with a friend of mine who had an older brother who was a senior in high school. This was in the days of MySpace. Her brother's best friend posted a drinking picture. He lost his full ride to college. Ever since then, and I was in seventh or eighth grade, I've never not thought about, you know, social media and how much it can really hurt you. And what happened to Kelly, it was super sad. And she knows that, you know, these kinds of things are, it's really tough and it happens to people. And it's things in the past being really sad coming back to bite you. But I know that in the end, she's going to come out strong and she's a fighter. And, you know, a lot of people in the business know her and they know the real her, and she feels really bad for what happened. And I know she's just going to grow from it and be bigger and better than ever.
The storm will blow over. I think we all know that. I think we all hope for that as well. I can't wait until she gets another opportunity, which she will. But I thought that was such a messed up situation. I thought her statement was strong. At what point can we move on from this? It's been so long. I've made mistakes. I'm sure you've made mistakes. How much longer do we have to keep repaying the same debt when it's already been settled?
Yeah, this is cancel culture. People are going through this in cancel culture all the time. It's very scary, the cancel culture, and everyone just has to be on high alert. And unfortunately, that's the world that we're living in right now. But the only way, I guess, to try to get past it is to just be better people ourselves and hope that if we continue to put good energy out into the atmosphere and into the universe, then hopefully the good energy will come back to us. And that's kind of the way that I approach all of this cancel culture. You just have to be careful with what you say, be careful who you say it to, and just try to be a good person to everybody. And this even is about trolls on social media. If you're a troll on social media and you're just trying to bring other people down, I can't imagine that it's making you feel any better in the long run.
She is Ariel Epstein, host of The Morning After on Sports Grid. Give her a follow at Ariel, A-R-I-E-L Epstein. I hear you're coming in hot to Boston first week of July. I am terrified for that because I think some other maniacs will be here as well, but it should be a great time, and I'm sure we'll have some stories afterwards.
I cannot wait. Boston soon. Maybe I'll give out the date. I don't know if we wanted to or not, but I'm super pumped because I guess I'll say that we're celebrating America, and that'll be great.
We will see you soon. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Sam.
That about does it for Chicken Dinner. Thanks to Ariel Epstein from Sports Grid for hopping on the show. You should have seen her shooting buckets in that pool. She wasn't even in the pool. She was on the deck, underhand, over the top, behind the back, just whoosh, whoosh, whoosh. I need my rematch. John Murray's pool is a very coveted place to play pool basketball, and I still can't believe that she showed me up in front of the crew. Record check, 134, 135, down 7.6. Not pleased, but things will get better. They always do. That's what happens when you follow up a 9-1 run with a 1-6 run. No fun. We got the Avs to win the series. That could be another loser. They need to win 6 and 7. Fingers crossed. Cross your toes, too. Why not? Coming up on the show next week, we will talk to Jason Mizrahi from Win Daily Sports. He's one of the best in the business at making those daily fantasy lineups. Cash up tickets, make some money. We'll talk to you next week right here on Chicken Dinner.
brother told me so. You